me a moment.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog
Good
Talk
morning,
Radio.
Everyone. Today,
this is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Sounds like I'm a little bit, jumping the gun, so my apology. But this is Westchester on the Level. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. It's December 11th, Monday. And I'm thrilled we already have John Bailey, the publisher and the editor of the White Plains Citizen-Net Reporter online. Good morning, John. Always a pleasure. I always look forward to Monday.
Good morning, Hezzy. And how are you?
I'm really feeling good. So I don't know.
That's great.
But what's happening on the world stage, on the political stage, is driving me crazy. But but then that's the way politics is. So
well,
what's
right
the most important issue that's come in front of you?
Well, what's in front of me right now is Adolf Hitler's appeal to the nation on the 15th of July of 1932, before his party, the National Socialist Party of Germany, took over the German majority in the Reichstag. I just wanted to read a couple of paragraphs of this speech because it sounds very familiar. The great time of decision has arrived. Destiny has given, and I'm going to substitute America for, and he refers to Germany, okay? The great time of decision has arrived. Destiny has given America's present rulers more than 13 years to prove themselves and to show what they can do. They themselves pronounce the most damning judgment on themselves, for by the very nature of their propaganda, today they acknowledge the failure of their efforts. Once they wanted to govern America better than it had been governed in the past, and all they can say about their art of governing is that America and the American people are not yet dead. In the days, they simply solemnly swore to lead our nation and the German workforce towards a better economic future. They have had almost 14 years to keep that promise, and they cannot cite a single American trade or profession as evidence of their success. And man, this is just, Hitler could have been talking about America today.
Absolutely.
It's just amazing to me how we are paralleling that whole era of the 30s.
Well, it's interesting that we're parroting what they went through in the 30s in Germany, but in Germany today, thousands rallied in Berlin against anti-Semitism, despite the fact that there's a 300% increase in crimes of Jewish people in Germany, also in Belgium. There are similar protests as well. So why is Europe waking up to this horror that brought about World War II, and why are we not seeing it here?
Well, I think we are, because what we are seeing is substitute immigrants for the word Jews, okay? And you see a national turning against immigrants, even though we need them to harvest our crops because the rich are going to do it. And, it's just cutting off our noses to spite our face. I mean, and the other thing is that this anti-Semitism has been inflamed by the intellectual youth of America. And I use that word loosely because, when you went to college and, there was protesting against the Vietnam War, it was a social event.
You went there to be part of a crowd protesting about something that you thought was wrong and that was not going anywhere. And maybe a lot of the protesters were earnest, but you also, it was a social coming together. You got dates if you protested.
That's true as well.
Yeah. So now what we got is this business on the campuses, which is really firing up anti-Israeli sentiment.
It definitely is, but I'm wondering, it seems that Jews are an anomaly on the world stage in the sense that while they may have been integrated in society like they were in Germany before Hitler came about, the only difference about them was the fact that they were Jews. And, I mean, even, like, I speak German, so you could normally tell the last name of a Jewish family from a non-Jewish family because the names were different, even though they were Germanic, but it was a Jewish-German name. But what's interesting is, what that told me then, because it was repeated and it's being repeated now all over the world, is the fact that whether you're Jewish or whether you're black or whether you're from one country or another, it seems that every nation somehow cannot inculcate a new migrant, whoever that migrant may be, no matter their background or their belief standard. Why is that? Are we just intolerant of people who are regarded as other and we can never mix? Is that the problem? And who makes that decision?
We are intolerant towards people we consider inferior to ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a hatred for people of Indian descent, not from India, American Indians. I don't understand where that comes from. I don't understand why.
Well, the Indians are a source of somewhat guilt by America because we took their land, much as was taken by any conqueror in the past. It was masked by a wonderful sounding cliche, manifest destiny.
I remember that, yes. I remember reading that.
It was
a public
relations dream. It was a public relations dream. It said, it is okay for us to break treaties if there's gold on the land or something like that, or we want to farm the land. And it's okay for us to kill buffalo herds to build our railroad. This is what happened to the Indians. They had something we wanted. It's like the Middle East had something we wanted too, oil.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's very true.
And we justified rather obnoxious policies to acquire that oil. And not only that, but we're still supporting that. The oil companies, apparently, from what I can see, haven't done too much or promised to do too much at Dubai climate conference, getting along just chummy with all the Arabs over there. It's just really
Absolutely. They're not curtailing the fossil fuels, and they're not looking for alternatives. Is the alternative for the world, is it going to be atomic energy? Or are we still too scared?
The atomic energy got a bad rap because people were afraid that it was a security risk, and it had leaks. Three Mile Island, as you recall, really gave a very bad face of atomic power. And now we just shut Indian Point down, and we're now worried. And apparently, they are not putting the tainted water, the radioactive water waste, into the Hudson. They're being forced
right.
by law in New York to shuttle it. We don't know if they've shuttled it off yet. Shuttled it
exactly.
by truck someplace. But, I mean, we don't know. I mean, why doesn't the press follow up on this stuff? They never do. We had a huge lead-up to Dubai. We had a huge lead-up to
yeah.
Dubai, and there is absolutely nothing, to what I can see, writing it up. They say, oh, we're going to give $300 million to help nations hurt, but there's no real curtailment.
No, none.
Commitment.
Why aren't we, since there's a fear of atomic energy, and we can't even get rid of the water that's used, to cool the reactors, because that becomes, infected by the, the residue.
The radioactive.
I remember recently
particles.
The radioactive aspect. So. It was very interesting because there was a big scandal for a little while. It was simmering about dumping the water into the ocean, which we did anyway, despite the who knows what how it's going to affect sea life. So we have no idea. So why aren't we going though with wind farms? Why don't we make that investment?
Well,
but
recently there has been an effort to really hurt Westchester Power, the original consortium group of which White Plains and Yonkers are members. And the situation is that I called up Westchester Power and I couldn't raise a human soul there. After the recent, has everybody gone home on vacation at Westchester Power? And Noam Bramson, who is taking over the group in January, well, he has a great deal of explaining to do why you can't get a comment from Westchester Power on what the present situation means for renewable energy, which they espouse. I mean, is this effort going to stop, or is Con Ed taking over a corner on it, I mean, that's what they do. That's
exactly.
what monopolies do. And that's what they did to Westchester Power. The ESCOs were forced to charge the top rate, which was for the most expensive power source, which was natural gas. And that's why Westchester Power rates climbed to virtually double what they were about a year ago. And this has not really been reported with any clarity by the press or commitment.
No, they haven't.
You can tell which side the press is on, but what they do not cover. Like, where is the transcript of Trump's awful speech Saturday night? Where is the transcript? I couldn't find one. We have video clips, but the Times in the past used to print transcripts. They don't do that anymore because they're too cheap. And it really makes me wonder what is going on with their judgment. That was a horrendous thing he did Saturday night. I openly heard little snatches of it. But that's why I looked up some Hitler speeches. This guy is rewriting Hitler's speeches. Let me read another paragraph.
Yeah. Sure.
But the worst thing is that they have destroyed the nation's faith, leaving it utterly without hope or confidence. How true is that? In 13 years, they have not succeeded in mobilizing the forces dormant with our nation. On the contrary, in their fear of awakening in the nation, they have created dissension.
pitting town against country, salaried workers against civil servants, blue-collar workers, white-collar workers, Bavarians against Prussians, Catholics, Protestants, and so on. And that is Adolf Hitler speaking at the Reichstag in 1932. Isn't that
it's unbelievable how prophetic it is. It's a very big
it
chill.
It really is. 1932.
Well, it's interesting. I remember my father many, many years ago told me that what happened in Germany would happen again. But not only would it happen, but it would happen in America. And I thought he was off his rocker. And yet, in the last few years, I realized that what he was able to recognize, because he lived through it, even though he was born in Poland, and my mother was German, and so they lived it. But my father explained it more from his perspective, and it's come about. And America's going
right.
and sliding into that unbelievable
Poland
abyss.
Poland was Hitler's first incursion, as I like to say today.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And even today, you know, with Russia doing what it's doing, Poland is in fear. It's the same situation again. Who knows if Russia wins in the Ukraine? And I don't even understand the circumstance why all of a sudden we're not supporting Ukraine because the Republicans want to end up promoting a much stronger effort. To make sure that I don't know exactly they want to make sure that we keep the border secure from anybody coming in. So why don't we make a policy
right.
that way? But that's what the Republicans are demanding it, but creating a crisis somewhere else. You know.
Right. Well, that's because that's what they want. That's because what they do not like.
That's what they want to do.
Laying people into the country who are not of the Caucasian persuasion. They just don't like it.
Right.
And I think any person of color who turns to support the Republican Party, and, you know, they're basically doing something that is counterproductive to thousands of people's success.
Well, you know what's interesting is that those people that espouse the bigotry and that are anti-people who are not white, supposedly, and they may be Hispanic or they may be from Asia, how come those disparate peoples from different ethnicities, how come they haven't come together and protested as one? Are they also divided?
Because
they're afraid
they'll be rounded up. They'll be afraid.
Yeah.
You can't protest as an ethnic group because we still have ISIS lurking around. And
absolutely.
They could, oh, wait. Did I say all right? No, it's iced. Ha, ha. That is a Freudian slip. Yeah, iced. Okay. But, I mean, it's not a funny Freudian slip. It's my devious brain letting out the truth. But anyway, this is why you don't see protests by the part of Latinos, Mexican-Americans, and I tell you, I was down in Port Chester last night, they have an enormous number of migrant-owned businesses down
South
there.
South American.
And we were sitting in a restaurant, and apparently there was an issue with someone who was in the restaurant, and police arrived, and
They handcuffed him and took him out. Now, we don't know what he had done, but it was something I had never seen in person, an actual handcuffing by a police officer of someone and taking them out of a restaurant. I mean,
I never did either.
It's not the same as on TV.
Yeah, exactly. It's not.
It's very tense. Police officer goes in. They've got members of the restaurant there guy was apparent. But we don't know why they were asking him to be removed by the police. But afterwards, the owner left, obviously to make a complaint against the person, who knows what. But the police at least responded, treated it very seriously. But that is what rings home, what a police officer faced. He's going in there, and he has several things. Should I go in with my weapon unholstered? Because he doesn't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Does he? Does he know? I mean, what a pressure! What a pressure!
Unbelievable! And, I don't know how they survive it. To be honest with you, it's
and not only that, but he's
got
to think. Wait, if shooting breaks out, how shall I react? You don't know, what you're going into.
It's ridiculous, you know. Like you're right, because in a restaurant, first of all, I can't even imagine what the situation would be where a restaurateur would have called up somebody, the police particularly, to get because they had a problem with an individual, or what the other rationale was for them entering the restaurant. But I can't
believe
the restaurant would be comfortable with it.
Yeah. Well, I thought
they're not going
to
hang around.
Our owner was very smart to do that. Yeah.
Mm.
Look, he had about 5 or 6 staff there with him. There was obviously some sort of security, and somebody had the intelligence to call the police.
Yeah. But that must have scared everybody, including you, at the restaurant, no?
Well,
it's been an unbelievable
sight. What's going to happen? Yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, the handcuffing was very quick.
Yeah, amazing.
It was.
Wow.
And my support to Portchester policemen who handled that situation and it didn't result in violence. That's the
It's amazing that they did such a good job. Absolutely. Unbelievable.
Well,
this
is what every owner down there who's a minority faces. What are you going to do someday that takes a person out of a normal situation and he assaults you or whatever?
Yeah.
Or she assaults you,
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, something
to
think about.
Are we ever
going to
be able to come together?
Yeah.
But do you think as a nation we could come together? We're split on political lines. We're split on ethnic lines. We're split on abortion rights. All these things, it's unbelievable. We're really undergoing a change in demeanor. I don't think this was around in the 60s. All of a sudden, what are we're drinking a new Kool-Aid? What's going on?
Well, we Trump is being celebrated much like Adolf Hitler for the wrong things.
He's got support. His popularity has increased to 50%. 50% of all those people standing to run for the Republican Party, he's at 50% now. It's unbelievable.
They want to
win. He will
win,
become the Republican candidate. Yeah, they do.
Yes, they're not going to nominate him. They're not going to nominate somebody who may be a little more centrist and not talking about putting people into concentration camps and putting mm-hmm. journalists in prison or attacking journalistic organizations. I mean, I was thinking seriously, if he became president, should I continue my website? Or, two, will he charge an enormous fee for using the internet if you're a journalism organization? He could do that.
Yes,
and,
he could.
And if you can do that, of course, he won't charge an enormous fee to comment on X, which is now worse than Twitter mm-hmm. ever was. It's run by a person
right.
who is not just a business person like the Twitter owner was, but I mean, I forget all these geniuses. And what about cryptocurrency?
Elon Musk. Oh, that's another disaster that we've permitted.
Oh, absolutely. And we let this guy out. This is finance.
I forgot his name now.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if you steal a loaf of bread, usually Jean Valjean analogy, and you're black, you
mm-hmm.
could be shot dead. Okay, but this guy actually does finances for Hamas and Al Qaeda, and this guy is walking around free. Come on,
absolutely.
For sentencing, that guy should be in a maximum security prison and charged with international terrorism abetment.
So, what,
you know?
In a sense, can you?
What were they thinking?
Well, what I don't understand is what was the change? What caused America to change to this sort of concept, which is like indicative of what happened in Germany and with our new Führer, Trump, and so on and so forth. What caused that? Do we know? Or is it just an opportunist like someone like Trump who came in and changed the demeanor with his arrogance and his demeaning presentation? And, he's like our new God.
Yeah.
Which is
unfortunately,
unbelievable.
He likes to think of himself as one.
Yes. Right.
And this is a very dangerous mindset to have. And why did it start? Well, let's say Hitler had a slogan, make Germany great again.
Yeah. Absolutely.
He didn't.
It's exactly the same. Yeah.
But it is exactly the same reason Trump got supported. He exploited people's fears and discontentment and,
Yes.
And he's doing that right now. And but I mean, the attacks on reporting, the attacks on journalists, the threat to jail them. Well, come on, you jail
absolutely.
That. Nobody's going to know what's going
on.
Heck, we don't know what's going on now.
I went through that myself. The PBA. The Yonkers Police Benevolence Association, they hated my guts because I believe, and I had proof, that they were doing wasn't on the level. And I wrote about it. And then they ended up suing. So it was just unbelievable that they could get away with it. And then there was even a judge that said, I'm not a journalist. I mean, I can't believe it. You know, it's just amazing what goes on.
No, you are the what do they call? You are the bellwether.
Yeah, exactly.
You were the first journalist to be attacked in Westchester in many years by a published entity, parts of which you pay their salary.
Exactly. It's so true.
Exactly.
Well, unfortunately,
and
John,
to settle that suit. You settled that suit, and you have moved on, and you have survived a tremendous single act of courage by a journalist. I don't think that Journal News wrote any editorial about this is wrong that you're being charged. No, they didn't.
No, they never did.
They are not journalists for never having supported you. No,
listen,
it's
John.
True.
Unfortunately, I've got to cut this short because Michael Edelman's already on the line. I didn't realize how quickly the time flew. We'll have to pick this up again next week.
Yes, and I'll read another
part.
Hitler speech. Correct. Okay.
That would be
fine,
terrific. Excellent.
Yeah.
Be well. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Okay, bear with me a moment here. We're going to bring in Michael Edelman. Okay, almost there. Good morning, Michael. Michael Edelman, how are you, sir?
Oh, good, Hezzy. How you doing?
Really, really quite well. It was very interesting. The first half hour with John Bailey from the White Plains Citizen-Net Reporter, and he was reading some of the statements from Hitler, which are reminiscent of the sort of stuff that we're hearing from Trump. And yet, I only read, I think it was either this morning or yesterday, that Trump's popularity rating is at 50% of the Republicans that are running. It's frightening.
Look, 35 to 40% of the Republican Party is the base. And they are going to vote for Donald Trump no matter what, because it's a cult.
Yeah.
Now, Donald Trump, when he was married to his first wife, Ivana, had a book of Hitler's speeches on his night table. So all of this stuff that he's saying, the vermin, blah, 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 this is what Stephen Miller is writing for him to say. He could no more put these sentences together than the man in the moon. He reads that teleprompter, but it's written by Stephen Miller or Jason Miller, and they're very carefully pandering to white Christian nationalists, and they think that's going to get him the presidency. He's got 50% in Iowa. He doesn't have 50% nationally.
No, right,
the
exactly.
Iowa caucus is 5 weeks away. He's going to romp because the evangelicals in Iowa support him. Then he goes on to New Hampshire, which is going to be a totally different story, in my opinion, because in New Hampshire, independent voters are allowed to vote in the Republican primary. So that means you're looking at Nikki Haley or Chris Christie doing much better, possibly, than Donald Trump. But look, as a practical matter, Donald Trump's going to be the nominee, which is why, in my judgment, the Democrats need to tell Joe Biden to retire a winner instead of running for a second term. He'll be 82 years old when he's inaugurated if he wins the election. That is too old to be president of the United States.
Yeah. And can we look forward to someone like a Newsom running?
I would say, and I put money on it, that Gavin Newsom will wind up the Democratic nominee. Now, that's a wild prediction, but my gut is that in the end, for various reasons, including the fact that his son Hunter could be facing jail time, Joe Biden will choose not to run.
Yeah. Boy, what a turn of events.
That's my opinion. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I understand. But the fact that Hunter Biden could have done what supposedly is alleged that he may have done, I think that's frightening when he knew that his father was the president of the United States. Is it always about money for everybody or most people?
Well, yeah. He used his last name to get Burisma, which is an energy company in Ukraine, to pay him $50,000 a month for what he was doing. Yeah. I really don't know. And it's obvious that what's obvious here is that although nothing now connects Joe Biden to his son's business, there may come a time in the future where there is a transfer of money from Hunter to Joe that doesn't look kosher. So
yeah,
I would hate to have Joe Biden on the ticket as the nominee when all of a sudden we learn, when it's too late to replace him, that something smells about his son's business deals and himself. So my opinion is Joe Biden shouldn't run, and he should know better. He's done a very good job. I give him credit for that for the last four years.
I think he has, yes.
Yep, and we're just seeing it now. We're seeing inflation come down. Unemployment is coming down, and the stock market's going up. So all I can say is that it's better than Trump because he has single-handedly kept NATO in business, which is should be our number one priority because it's the Western civilization versus Putin, because Putin is in Ukraine, and if it was Donald Trump, he was going to dissolve NATO, which would allow Putin to do whatever he wanted in Eastern Europe, like to take over Latvia, Estonia, you name it. He could take over the little countries. And without NATO, there'd be nothing that anybody could do about it.
Exactly.
So
why is the Republican Party, don't they realize what could happen, ramifications?
Well, yeah. Yeah, moderate Republicans realize what could happen. Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger,
yes, Liz Cheney.
Mitt Romney, and plenty of others that know Donald Trump is a threat to democracy but are afraid to say so because of death threats from his followers.
Right.
The Republican Party has been captured by fascists. This is now a fascist party. Donald Trump is a fascist. He speaks like a fascist.
Yeah.
He has indicated that he is their retribution. He's into revenge. He's a petty tyrant. And if he is, I'll tell you one thing, if he is elected to the presidency, I will not live in this country. I'll be in Italy or Spain or Portugal.
Yeah, yeah.
Where the food is terrific and the sun shines. That's what we'll do.
Portugal is phenomenal. I loved it when I was there.
That's what I hear.
I was mostly in Lisbon and in the Algarve. Unbelievable, unbelievably beautiful. And the food is terrific.
Yeah.
So it's
fascinating.
Can't go wrong
eating seafood the rest of your life. Or lamb.
Not at all. Not at all.
I will not live in a country where I know the leader is going to try and subvert the democratic process. That's not going to happen. And that's exactly what he'll do. And he said it. This is not a secret. I'm not telling you anything that is my opinion. I'm telling you factually he has said that on day one, he's going to be a dictator. He'll appoint people around him that will do his bidding, that will break the law, that will use the Department of Justice to go after his political enemies. He said that. I am not saying that.
Yeah, he did.
Okay, so I won't live in this country if that's the case.
What I don't understand
because
is...
I would be in jeopardy, by the way, because Jeanine Pirro is close to him, and I have been extremely critical of Jeanine Pirro. So I wouldn't, I wouldn't want to stay here under those circumstances.
Absolutely, absolutely not. I agree with you. We're, like, for example, with a woman like Nikki Haley running, she got a lot of support. From the dais, and so she did very well. why aren't women coming out for someone like her? Is it that they're just so on an average between men and women, it makes no difference. Trump is like the new savior.
That's exactly it. They view Trump as a vessel from God. believe that. They believe that. That's why they're willing to excuse all of his sins, as it were.
Yes, all of his foibles.
Because they
believe he's exactly what Hitler did.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. He's following the playbook.
Absolutely.
And that's dangerous.
Can America escape?
Somebody's got to stop. Somebody has to stop him.
Well, Chris Christie is one thing that's very interesting. I figured Nikki Haley would do very well, but she's waned somehow. And Chris Christie, is it because he is heavy? He's a very heavy-set guy. Is that the reason he's not credibility?
No. We've had a president bigger than Christie. Howard Taft. Taft was enormous. He had to change the bathrooms. He had to change the commodes in the bathroom. He was so fat.
Yeah.
So that's not what's doing it. Chris Christie is a moderate Republican, and the Republican Party is simply a cult now.
Yes. So he can't win because of that.
No, that's right. But the problem is, here's the problem.
Yeah.
I mean, states like Michigan, which Joe Biden has to have because of what he has done with Benjamin Netanyahu in terms of being – you know, right next to him and supporting him 100%, he has pissed off all the Arab Americans that live in Dearborn. And you're talking about a couple hundred thousand people who will not vote for Joe Biden. They're not going to vote for Donald Trump, but they'll not vote, period. And so because of the action he's taken, he's lost considerable support among the Arab community. These are Arab Americans. They're good American citizens, but they have sympathy for their relatives in Gaza. And what Israel is doing there is not good. It's just not good.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to believe Hamas's numbers on death, but it's thousands of people. It may not be 15,000, but it's absolutely thousands of people. And 3/4 of those people are women and children.
Yeah.
Well, that's why you're seeing a rise in anti-Semitism.
Could there have been a different? Well, yes. It's up like 300% in Germany, and similarly in Belgium and in other places. And I can't even imagine what it's like here in the United States. So has Israel's move been just inappropriate at the end of the day?
Yes, I think so.
So
I think their decision to eliminate Hamas by bombing the entire Gaza Strip will bring to the Netanyahu government the war crimes ultimately because they're killing innocent people. I don't care who Hamas is. They're a terrorist organization, but what they're doing in terms of wiping out the buildings in Gaza is they're killing regular people.
Well, how does one react, for example? I'm not saying that Israel's been right, but how does a state like Israel or any other nation, when Hamas, they raped the women, they mutilated them, and they
I
also raped men and mutilated them as well. They literally cut the penis off men.
Yeah. What they did was horrible. But you don't counter horrible with horrible. That is not an excuse to kill people, to kill humans.
No, 100% right. So, but why, for example, Israel is not sending food or to Gaza to Hamas because they don't want to. They just don't want to support them. But how come food isn't coming in from across Egypt from through the Rafah border? Why isn't Egypt supporting Hamas?
I have no idea.
Why Egypt isn't
loading the food? But here's the thing, Hezi. So Israel, the problem here is that most people conflate Jews with Israel. But as a practical matter, Jews that live in the United States don't necessarily support the right-wing government in Israel.
Right.
But that
that's
doesn't
very
matter.
True. And
that
the same thing in other countries, too.
Yeah, because for the last 30 years, the Palestinians have been treated like garbage. Netanyahu doesn't want a two-state solution. He wants one state. The business with the settlers going into the West Bank, making it impossible to have a contiguous state, okay, was only because the right-wingers there insisted on that in return for supporting Netanyahu. And Netanyahu is out for Netanyahu and wants to remain prime minister, and he's made a deal with the devil. And now he's getting payback.
Well, I've got to ask you, though, when I look at the so-called integration in America, it's not very well integrated. There are divisions on a million and one levels. But the same thing in other countries as well. Is it conceivable that people who strive for making more money or having a better life in a different society, they don't seem to inculcate the society that they enter? You know, it is absolutely amazing. If you want to come to America, then don't you become a little bit more American, even though
Definitely.
You may have, you know, but people are not doing that. You know, it's amazing. Whoever comes to America, people from Africa, people from South America, people from Asia.
When the first generation comes here, they usually end up in cliques. They don't immediately fall into the pot. They're not
become
they're
integrated.
Not assumed into the, yeah, when the Jews came here, they lived in the Lower East Side. They spoke Yiddish. But three generations later, they're doctors and lawyers. The Italians came here, the same thing. They were on the lower portion of Manhattan. They had their own thing. They spoke Italian. But three generations later, they're doctors and lawyers. It's not automatic. When these people get here,
you're right. I was mistaken. You're 100% right. I didn't recognize that, you know, in my own mind right now. But you're right. It does take generations.
It takes three generations.
Know, most people, and most people today have no idea how to speak Yiddish. Very, very few do.
Yeah,
so,
it
was a different generation.
The cute sayings are left over, like verklempt, right?
Yeah.
There are a couple of words that everybody uses. They're not necessarily used by only Jews. So that's what's left over.
Exactly. Just like a couple of words here and there. You're right, 100% right. Most people couldn't speak one sentence in Yiddish or in German none of that stuff.
Exactly.
It is interesting. And I do hear, for example, in New York, because I live in New York, I do hear a lot more Spanish everywhere you go. But like you said, eventually that too will wane. I won't live long enough to see that loss of the language.
I enjoy that because I speak Spanish, Hezi.
Oh, that's terrific.
I enjoy that because I speak Spanish.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm thinking of I speak a lot of languages, but I have to start to learn how to speak Spanish because
you know what
just
you
out
do?
Of respect
there's
for
a,
people.
There's a program and there's an app called Babbel, B-A-B-B-E-L.
Yes.
If you just get that app and it takes you through conversational Spanish, and if you spend a little time with it, you'll be able to pay. I mean, you'll be able to speak.
I will. Absolutely. I'm going to do that. That's a good point. I keep forgetting
and then we can
to do that.
We can do the blog. We can do the blog show in Spanish.
In Spanish, that would be phenomenal. That would be very, very good. But yeah, that would be excellent. What a great idea. So that'll be the impetus for me to learn Spanish. All the more reason. That is fantastic.
Yep.
So what else is important? Why isn't it that Nikki Haley didn't rise to a higher level? Why is it that Chris Christie didn't either? What's wrong with them? Or is it just simply that the big elephant in the room is going to be Trump and that'll be the final day? Hitler reincarnate.
Yes, it's unfortunate that people in this country, younger people, do not have a memory of the fascists in the 1930s. But Trump, I wouldn't say Trump's Adolf Hitler, but he's definitely Benito Mussolini. Because I told you this 6 years ago.
Yes, you did.
If you watch his facial,
yes, you did. I remember.
When you watch his face when he talks, it's Mussolini on a balcony.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain amount of people in this country that want a strong man. They want an authoritarian. They don't like democracy because in a democracy based on merit, your color doesn't matter. And these people do not have higher education. And they look at other communities like the black community and the Latinos. They go to school. They get an education. And they wind up as professionals. And these other white Christians lose their social status, they think, because of diversity.
Uh-huh.
They're not for diversity. They're against diversity. And that means they're against democratic society. They'd rather see a strong man. They'd rather see a strong man.
And what do they think a strong man will do for them? That's what I don't understand.
That's right. Because a strong man will get the liberals. That's what he'll do. He'll protect those non-college educated white Christians, protect them from the elites who run the educational system and run the finance system. Okay? And they will protect them from guys like George Soros.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Exactly.
Boy, this is like topsy-turvy. I would never have thought about this 10 years ago, but, Trump has certainly impacted our political system. I would never have expected that. I remember my father years ago had said, what happened in Germany will happen here. And I thought he was off his rocker. It turns out that he's right, and it's mind-boggling to me. I never thought America would come to this point.
Hesse, we're not there yet. We're not there yet. We will be if Donald Trump wins another term. And if you're still doing the blog talk, then you'll be doing. I'll be calling in from Portugal.
Well, I'll probably move there with you. Absolutely very frightening. But you love Portugal. I haven't spent that much time in Italy, only a week or two, but Portugal I absolutely loved. And the Algarve is fantastic.
I like that whole area. It's the Costa del Sol. Whether it's Portugal or Spain or Italy, in the Mediterranean, that's a great place to retire. So,
absolutely, it really is, and the people are wonderful. So, it just is what it is. So, where do we go from here? Is there a way? Is there a way for things to change? Is it conceivable that the president might step down and not run again?
I hope so.
I can't even imagine he's thinking about it.
Because if you look at the polling, right, from the states that are swing states. You forget about New York and California. The blue states and the red states are going to do what they want. There are six states that will determine who the president is. Okay? And in those
California.
Six states, as of now, Trump is – no, not California. Michigan, right? Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Georgia.
Uh-huh.
Arizona. Colorado. Mm. And – and Wisconsin or Minnesota, one of the two of them. So those are the states that count. In all of those states, Joe Biden is behind Donald Trump.
Uh-huh. And there just doesn't seem to be any roadway for him eclipsing Trump at this. 'Cause Biden doesn't have joie de vivre. You know, he just doesn't have what it takes to become, you know, such a stand-up guy for the Democratic Party. So who can? Is it going to be Newsom? Will Newsom step up?
Oh, I don't know. They're not going to. I don't think these guys will step up while Joe Biden is still on the ticket. Biden has to make the decision not to run. Nobody's going to push him out. And here's the other problem. You got Bobby Kennedy Jr., who is going to be running third party. You've got Jill Stein, who says she's going to be running on the Green Party. And when you poll based on all of these people, Trump wins because those candidates take votes away from more votes away from Biden than from Trump.
Yeah. Wow.
So,
what a potential outcome. I don't think anyone thought about this before. Well, you're ahead of the game anyway. It's fascinating. Oh, goodness. Any last words from you? What should we be looking for in the future? Or are we just waiting for either Biden to consider running or not running? Do you think he's thinking about it?
You got 5 weeks. Right? They're going to start polling, and there's polling every day, basically. If you go to realpolitics.com, you'll see a collection of all the polls day by day. And Joe Biden's not doing well. And I know it's a year and a half. It's over a year away. I understand that. However, he's in bad shape.
Well, if he wants a Democrat to win, he would need to step down, for sure.
Correct.
He wouldn't want to be undermine.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be his rationale, I would think.
I would think.
Wow.
Step down because of his son. He loves his son. He needs to pay attention to the predicament that he's in. I would even suggest he should pardon his son and then not run. Donald Trump did it. He pardoned Roger Stone.
That's true.
Pardoned Paul Manafort. He pardoned all his friends.
Yeah.
Joe can pardon.
That would be a smart move.
And then he doesn't run.
That would be.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That makes a lot of sense. I never thought of that. No,
yes,
not.
They
that's
would.
What, that's why you pay me the big bucks.
Unbelievable. Absolutely. but not enough. I need to raise your salary.
Yeah.
Listen,
okay.
All the best to you. Thank you again.
Exactly. All right. I'll see you next week.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
It would be my pleasure. All the best. Thank you. Bye. Boy, none other than the immaculate thinking process of none other than Michael Edelman, national political analyst and international political analyst Michael Edelman, Esquire. Just a phenomenal capacity to contemplate and to recognize and to distill the situation. Well, if you don't know German, I will translate it for you. And the demonstration in Germany was Nie wieder ist jetzt, which means never again is now. And in Germany, thousands have rallied in Berlin against anti-Semitism, which is fascinating that it's happening of all places in Germany. Germany has recorded a 300% increase in crimes against Jewish people since the Israel-Hamas conflict erupted in October. A similar protest in the Belgian capital also drew thousands of people. So several thousand people protested on Sunday in the German capital of Berlin against anti-Semitism, hatred, and racism. The march came amid a rise in anti-Semitic incidents since the October 7 Hamas attacks on Israel and the launch of Israel's offensive in Gaza. A similar protest was held in the Belgian capital of Brussels in support of the country's Jewish community. So never again is now, is the line. In Berlin, demonstrators braved heavy rain as they moved from the Tiergarten to the Brandenburg Gate under the motto, Never Again Is Now, a reference to the Holocaust and the crimes committed by the Nazi government. Estimated that the number of participants at 3,200, while organizers said they expected 10,000 people to take part. Josef Schuster, the president of the Central Council of Jews, said at the event that he sometimes didn't recognize Germany as, quote, something has gotten out of hand, end quote, referring to a rise in anti-Semitic incidents in recent years, particularly since the start of the most recent Israel-Hamas conflict. Quote, there is still an opportunity to repair the situation, but to do so, you also have to admit that what has gone wrong in the last few years, what you were unable or unwilling to see, he added. The protest was also attended by Labor Minister Hubertus Heil and Bundestag President Bärbel Bas. Germany banned several pro-Palestinian demonstrations in recent weeks after some protesters chanted anti-Semitic slogans during earlier rallies. The country has also reiterated hundreds of criminal offenses against Jewish people and Jewish institutions, including synagogues and schools. A pro-Palestinian demonstration was, however, held in downtown Berlin on Sunday, drawing up to 2,500 people at its peak, according to the police. Brussels rally drew about 4,000 people. Marchers at the Brussels rally waved Belgian flags and held up signs reading, quote, you don't have to be Jewish to march against anti-Semitism, end quote, anti-Semitism kills, quote, end quote, and other slogans. Joel Rubenfeld, president of the Belgian League Against Anti-Semitism, said that Belgium has witnessed, quote, a huge increase, quote, end quote, in anti-Jewish hatred over the past 2 months, quote, we are living in a very complicated period, end quote, he said, adding that the rally sent, quote, a message to the Jewish community of Belgium to tell them that they are not alone, end quote. Now, Sunday's protests were the latest in a series of rallies in European capitals showing support for Jewish communities, including those in London and Paris. Unbelievable. Now, why the River to the Sea pro-Palestinian slogan is controversial. Among the ongoing Israel-Gaza conflict, from the River to the Sea, quote-unquote, has emerged as a contentious pro-Palestinian slogan, and some maintain it's anti-Semitic, while others describe it as a call for equal rights. The Jordan River winds its way from the northeastern tip of Israel down through the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea. Along most of its 250 kilometers, it's about 155 miles long. The river forms the border between Israel and the West Bank on one side and the Kingdom of Jordan on the other. This length is almost the same as that of the combined Mediterranean coastline of Israel and the Gaza Strip to the west. The strip of land between the river in the east and the sea in the west is barely 60 kilometers wide. Geographically, it's quite clear that the slogan, from the river to the sea, end quote, encompasses Israel, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. And the precise political message conveyed by the slogan is, however, highly contentious. At the beginning of November, it was banned by the German Interior Ministry, who considered it to be a symbol of the Hamas organization. Well, the slogan reappears amid Israel-Hamas conflict. So during the terrorist attacks perpetrated by the Islamist militant group Hamas on October 7, Israel reports at least 1,200 people were killed and around 240 more were abducted and taken hostage. Along with the subsequent Israeli offensive in Gaza, which has so far resulted in the deaths of over 11,000 Palestinians, there have been numerous solidarity marches and rallies around the world in support of both sides. Some of these demonstrations have been criticized for spreading Islamist and anti-Semitic propaganda. While the slogan "From the River to the Sea, Palestine will be free," end quote, is often chanted at pro-Palestinian demonstrations, abbreviated to "From the River to the Sea," end quote, it circulates widely on social media and is often found on various items available online, including candles, flags, and sweatshirts. It is currently the subject of considerable debate, though the slogan itself has actually been around for decades. Now, many activists for Palestinian rights describe it as a call for peace and equality after decades in which millions of Palestinians have lived under Israeli occupation. Others interpret it as a clear call for the destruction of Israel. So where does, quote, "From the River to the Sea" originate? The expression, quote, "From the River to the Sea," end quote, was first used by the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, in 1964. In its founding charter, the PLO demanded the establishment of a single Palestinian state extending from the Jordan River to the establishment to the Mediterranean Sea, decisively rejecting the United Nations 1947 partition plan for Palestine. So after the Six-Day War of 1967, the phrase was increasingly taken up by other Palestinian groups who also used it as a call for the liberation of their territories from Israeli occupation. They included peaceful initiatives promoting Palestinian independence, but also increasingly radical organizations such as the People's Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, and Hamas, which was founded in 1987. So both Hamas and the PFLP are designated as terrorist organizations by the European Union, the United States, Germany, and other nations. Hamas prominently used the slogan around 2012 when its then leader, Khaled Mashal, declared in a speech to mark the 25th anniversary of the founding of the group that, quote, "Palestine is ours from the river to the sea, from the south to the north." In 2017, this statement was included in the revised charter of the terrorist organization, which also called for the violent destruction of the State of Israel. In December of 2022, Hamas published the slogan again, along with a map of the region depicting a Palestinian state and no Israel. Is the pro-Palestinian slogan peaceful or radical? Well, in terms of what, quote, "a free Palestine from the river to the sea," end quote, would mean to for Israel's right to exist, the slogan is ambiguous. Consequently, it can be and is used by both peaceful and radical players. In 2021, for example, the Palestinian U.S.-American scholar Youssef Munayel argued that the phrase, quote, "from the river to the sea," end quote, was simply a description of the space in which Palestinians had been denied numerous rights since their expulsion in 1948 in the occupied territories, but also in Israel itself. According to Munayer, it expresses the desire for, quote, "a state in which Palestinians can live in their homeland as free and equal citizens, neither dominated by others nor dominating them." Munayer, the head of the Palestine/Israel program at the Arab Center in Washington, wrote on X earlier this month, quote, "there isn't a square inch of the land between the river and the sea where Palestinians have freedom, justice, and equality, and it has never been more important to emphasize this than right now," end quote. So is the slogan anti-Semitic? Many do not accept this room for interpretation. On this side, the slogan is widely perceived as anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist and a barely disguised call for the annihilation of Israel. An open letter published in early November and signed by 30 Jewish media outlets around the world states, quote, have no doubt that Hamas is cheering those, quote, from the river to the sea, end quote, chants, because a Palestine between the river to the sea leaves not a single inch for Israel. Similarly, the American Jewish Committee asserts on its website, quote, there is, of course, nothing anti-Semitic about advocating for Palestinians to have their own state. However, calling for the elimination of the Jewish state, praising Hamas or other entities who call for Israel's destruction, or suggesting that the Jews alone do not have the right to self-determination is anti-Semitic, end quote. Well, their argument is that the use of the slogan has become intolerable due to radical Palestinian organizations having adopted it and claiming it as their own. So how Western countries are treating the slogan? The main bone of contention remains, does the slogan exclude or include the Israeli people, end quote? Is it simply calling for equality for Palestinians or the conquest and obliteration of the state of Israel? Germany's judiciary was also divided on the question for a long time. The slogan was deemed to be protected by laws governing freedom of expression, under which statements were only considered criminal if they incited violence, and that was not held to have been definitively established in this case. This opinion has now been revised, and the German Interior Ministry has, quote, prohibited the use of the slogan in Germany, end quote. It considers it an indication of support for Hamas and a call for violence against Jews and against the State of Israel. Anyone using it could face fines for, quote, incitement to hatred, end quote, or even, in a worst-case scenario, a jail sentence of up to 3 years, and some states are already pursuing the first criminal prosecutions. Similar controversies have arisen in other countries about the use of the slogan. In October, a demonstration was banned in Austria because of it. In the United Kingdom, lawmaker Andy MacDonald was suspended from the Labour Party for using the phrase Palestinian rally. And in the United States, the House of Representatives issued a rebuke to Democrat Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, the only member of the U.S. Congress with Palestinian roots. She had condemned the attacks by Hamas, but afterward repeatedly criticized Israel's actions in Gaza, during which she used a controversial slogan. Now let's look at something else. What is the Palestinian Nakba and why does it matter? On May 15th, Palestinians around the world commemorate the 75 years of having lost their homeland. What is the Nakba? How does it tie into the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and why is it still relevant today? So what does Nakba mean? The Arabic word Nakba means catastrophe or disaster. In reference to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the term Nakba or Al-Nakba refers to the Palestinians having lost their homeland during and after the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. It's thought that around 700,000 people in what is now Israel either fled or were forced from their homes. Many Palestinian refugees abroad remain stateless to this day. So what is Nakba Day? On May 15, 1948, was the beginning of the Arab-Israeli War. It has long been a day that Palestinians take to the streets to protest against their displacement. Many carry Palestinian flags, bring the keys of their former homes, or carry banners with the symbols of the hope of returning home and what the community sees as their right to return. In the past, some protests have turned into violent clashes. Israel has accused Hamas and other organizations that are listed by the European Union and other countries as terror organizations of using the day for further their causes. The term Nakba Day was coined in 1998 by then-Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. He set the date as the official day for the commemoration of the loss of the Palestinian homeland. So why did Palestinians leave or have to leave? Until the end of World War I, Palestine was under Turkish rule as part of the Ottoman Empire. It then fell under British control, the so-called Mandate for Palestine. And during that period, which was marked by growing anti-Semitism in Europe, an increasing number of Jews from around the world moved there to what they see as their ancestral homeland, Eretz Yisrael, the promised land where Jews had always been living, albeit in much smaller numbers. After the experience of the Holocaust in Nazi Germany, a United Nations partition plan for Palestine was adopted by the United Nations General Assembly. The Arab League rejected the plan, but the Jewish Agency for Palestine accepted. On May 14 of 1948, the State of Israel was proclaimed. As a reaction, a coalition of the Arab states declared war, but was eventually defeated by Israel in 1949. Before the war, between 200,000 and 300,000 Palestinians had already left or been forced out and during the fighting. A further 300,000 to 400,000 Palestinians were displaced. The overall figure is estimated to be around 700,000 people. So during the war, more than 400 Arab villages were destroyed. While human rights violations were committed on both sides, the massacre of Deir Yassin, a village on the road between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, is particularly engraved in Palestinian memory to this day. At least 100 people were killed, including women and children. The event triggered widespread fear among Palestinians and prompted many to flee their homes. By the end of the war, Israel held around 40% of the area initially earmarked for the Palestinians by the United Nations Partition Plan of 1947. So where did the Palestinians go? Most of the Palestinians ended up as stateless refugees in the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and neighboring Arab countries. Only a minority moved further abroad. Until today, only a fraction of the next generation Palestinians have applied for or received other citizenships. As a result, the vast majority of the currently around 6.2 million Palestinians in the Middle East has remained stateless from the third or fourth generation. So where do they live today? According to the United Nations Dedicated Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA, spelled United Nations RWA, most Palestinians in the region still live in refugee camps, which over time turned into refugee towns. They are mainly based in the Gaza Strip, in the occupied West Bank, Lebanon and Syria, Jordan and East Jerusalem. The international Palestinian diaspora is estimated to have increased to some 6 to 7 million people. If accurate, this would put the total number of Palestinians close to 13 million people. There is, however, no global body keeping track of Palestinians in the diaspora, and accurate data is not available. So what is a Palestinian right to return? According to the United Nations General Assembly Resolution 194 in 1948, as well as the United Nations 2006 in 1974, and the 1951 Convention on the Status of Refugees, Palestinians who are considered Palestinian refugees have the right to return, quote unquote. Israel, however, has rejected the, quote, right to return, end quote, for Palestinians, stating that this would mean an end to Israel's identity as a Jewish state. Israel has denied responsibility for the displacement of Palestinians, pointing out that between 1948 and 1972, around 800,000 Jews were expelled or had to flee from Arab countries like Morocco, Iraq, Egypt, Tunisia, and Yemen. So are there suggestions for solutions? Over the past 75 years, there have been different approaches to resolving the Palestinian issue. The most significant one remains a two-state solution with Israel and a future Palestine dividing Jerusalem into two capitals. However, there are doubts on both sides over how realistic this would be. Critics have pointed to the increasing number of Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank, which could rule out a united Palestinian territory. Other suggestions are the recognition of the refugee status of Israel and a compensation but without a return, or limited resettlement, or a two-passport system in one state. However, a tangible solution remains out of sight for now. Now, the ongoing struggle of Palestinian refugees. In May 1948, Israel declared its independence. Palestinians such as Hafida Hatib refer to this moment as the Nakba, or catastrophe. With her family, Hafida fled to Lebanon, a country that has never felt like home. Following the outbreak of the Arab-Israeli War in 1948, 19-year-old Hafida Hatib and her family fled from the Palestinian village of Deir al-Hassi to a neighboring Lebanon. Quote, "I have lived in Lebanon for 70 years, but I've never forgotten Palestine," says Hafida, who is now almost 90 years old. Well, today she lives in the Burj al-Barajne refugee camp, which lies in the south of Lebanon's capital, Beirut. Camp residents like to quip that not even a coffin will fit through its narrow streets. Many houses are run down and at risk of collapsing. 3 years ago, Hafida moved into a small ground floor apartment after her leg was amputated because of complications from diabetes. Hafida's apartment would be hard to find without someone leading the way through the cramped maze of homes. The camp was originally intended to temporarily shelter Palestinians, but it still exists today. Having become a home for several generations of refugees, it has grown. Official figures put the number of Palestinians living in the camp at more than 18,000. The more recent influx of Syrian refugees most likely means that 40,000 people now live there. About half of the residents are younger than 25 years of age, and camp life is all that many know. But Hafida vividly remembers a different life. She recalls Deir al-Hassi, just 20 kilometers or about 12 miles from the city of Akko in what is now northern Israel. "If I could return, I would know exactly where our house stood," she says, adding that she knows just how everything was, quote, "our life, our land, the villages," end quote. And Hafida recalls how her father had told her they would not stay in Lebanon for long. Quote, "he said it would just be 3 or 4 weeks," end quote, she says with a melancholic mien. Despite her warm smile, quote, "we all really believe that," end quote. Well, shortly after Israel was declared an independent state, 5 neighboring Arab states attacked it. Israel fought back, forcing Arabic residents in many regions to flee. Palestinians referred to the beginning of this exodus at Nakba, or the catastrophe. On October 30 of 1948, Israeli forces conquered and depopulated Deir al-Hassi, Hafida's hometown. By that time, Israeli forces had already been battling Egyptian, Lebanese, Syrian, Iraqi, and Jordanian armies for several months. In prior weeks, hundreds of other Palestinian villages had already been taken over by the Israelis. Hafida's family was prepared. They had packed their bags. Quote, "we only took the bare necessities," she says. Quote, "we locked our door and set off," end quote. Hafida, her father, and her 5 siblings fled north into Lebanon. Her mother had passed away when Hafida was still a little girl. Quote, "there was a Christian village next to ours. We used to tend the land together," Hafida says, "and our Jewish neighbors often came to visit. Sometimes they brought homemade yogurt," she says. "Muslims, Christians, and Jews got on well. None of our friends wanted us to flee, but we were very scared." And those who did not flee were forced to leave. By May of 1949, Israeli forces had taken all villages in the vicinity of Deir al-Hassi. Today, only a few ruins of former houses remain, remind passersby that Palestinians once lived there. The villages were renamed Deir al-Hassi, is now called El-Kosh. In the end of the war in 1949, 750,000 Palestinians had fled or been forced from their homes. Some took shelter in refugee camps in Gaza and the West Bank. Most, however, fled to neighboring Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. Hafida remembers her family's small house. She still has the key, but it no longer exists. She must contend with renting a dark apartment. Lebanon does not allow Palestinians to own land or housing. After fleeing, Hafida married her cousin Ibrahim. They had 10 children. In 1978, Hafida, her husband, and children moved to the camp. One of 12 in Lebanon, served and financed by the United Nations Relief and Workers Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, UNRWA. Lebanon does not contribute any funding to the maintenance of the camps. Hafida has been living on her own since her husband died 8 years ago. She thinks life in the camp was not bad. But we and my kids had no real opportunity either, she says. Some of Hafida's children applied for asylum abroad. Her son, Subi Khatib, now lives in Denmark. Two other children live in the United States. One of her sons died in 1976 in Lebanon's civil war, which fills Hafida with immense sorrow. She has a framed picture of him above the apartment door. Her other six children still live in the camp. None are welcome, though. None of Lebanon's various governments were particularly welcoming of Palestinian refugees. The children of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon inherit their parents' status. That means that Hafida may not take jobs that require an academic degree. Refugees are paid less than equally qualified Lebanese nationals. These restrictions were officially justified by arguments that Palestinians who became fully integrated into Lebanese society will find it harder to return to their homeland. Neither Hafida nor her children feel accepted by Lebanese society. Quote, we don't want to live like a long-term guest, said Hafida's son, Zubi, who is visiting his mother. Quote, we want to live with dignity in our homeland. I grew up with Palestine. I carry it in my heart. Zubi no longer wanted to live in Lebanon. He feels much more welcome in his new home of Denmark. Well, Beirut's League of the Camps. Hafida never wanted to move into Beirut proper. She prefers the refugee camp, which everyone here simply calls Bourj, to the loud and bursting Lebanese capital. She likes that the camp residents are conscious of their heritage. Quote, I always cooked Palestinian dishes for my children, Hafida says. Quote, and they all speak Palestinian Arabic. End quote. She also told her children and grandchildren about the Nakba of day two. We'll never forget what happened. Zubi claims that the UNRWA school prohibit teaching the history of Palestine. Hafida's last wish. Around 450,000 Palestinian refugees are registered with the UNRWA in Lebanon. The agency's coffers are very limited, especially now that President Donald Trump has cut the United States' contribution. Because she needs to use a wheelchair, Hafida rarely leaves her apartment. Quote, the roads are bad, she says. My children cook for me and sometimes a lady comes over to help, end quote. It had been a long time since she visited the camp's market square, which some here mockingly refer to as, quote, Piccadilly Circus, end quote. Despite her age and frailty, Hafida would love to see her homeland one last time. Quote, my dream is to spend 1 week in Palestine, end quote, she says. I want to touch the soil and then be buried there. end quote. She knows that her last wish will never come true, even though international law and United Nations Resolution 194 officially grant her the right to return. In Israel, reference to either fall or to either of these concepts fall on deaf ears. Bear with me a moment. One second. Let's look at something else. With regard to Israeli independence, it's a bittersweet celebration. As a teenager, Israeli musician Noga Eretz lived through the terror attacks of the Second Intifada. She spoke about Israeli independence, national pride, and the two-state solution with Deutsche Welle. Noga Eretz is a singer-songwriter from Israel, who originally studied classical composition. Today she makes energetic electropop, and her latest album, Off the Radar, quote-unquote, was released in June of 2017. She sat down with Deutsche Welle's Sarah Judith Hoffman in Tel Aviv to talk about 70 years of independence in her home country. Deutsche Welle asked, on May 14 of 1948, David Ben-Gurion declared Israel an independent state. You were born in Israel. You grew up there. Is there a sense of pride about what your ancestors achieved? She says, I hate the word pride. It has this nationalistic sound. No, I'm proud of a lot of things here. At the same time, I'm in the process of realizing what a lot of the people who came here 100 years or 70 years ago had been through before coming here. Jewish people have not just been persecuted in Europe, but all over the world. They escaped. They were refugees. They had been through horrible things. They lost family generations. Both sides of my family in Europe were deleted. I'm realizing how traumatized they were and how they needed to rebuild themselves, not just building a country, but building themselves mentally. I think that this country was built in 70 years has a lot to do with the urge to survive. It's the strongest fuel for acceleration of culture and technology. This is still true today. If you think about the wars here that accelerated other processes, the cyber nation, it's all because we have to. It's crazy how these ugly forces are the best accelerators. So am I proud? It's bittersweet, she says. As you mentioned, Deutsche Welle says, as you mentioned, Israel is a mix of people, mostly Jewish people, who came as refugees from all over the world. Your music, you mix very different sounds within one song. Is this inspired by the place you live in? So she says, I get a lot from walking around Tel Aviv and crossing the border to Yaffa. This adds another flavor to the mixture. 10 minutes from here, you are in an Arabic city. This is stunning. Tel Aviv, for me, is a place which has the potential to be the most beautiful place on earth because of the mixture of people and of culture. The beach, the city, everything together. But at the same time, it has a very strong frequency and noise of complexity. There is something harsh about it, dirty and something complex. This place is beautiful and amazing, but it exists due to things that happened very recently and are still happening. And that blends into the atmosphere and eventually into my work and the sound in a very clear way. So Deutsche Welle then says, in one of your songs, you ask, can you dance while you shoot, end quote. When I listened to it, I had to think of living in the so-called, quote, party bubble, end quote. Tel Aviv, while people are being shot just 60 minutes from here in the Gaza Strip. Was this on your mind when you wrote this line? It's a song about escapism and the duality of living in the Western world. It's not just about Tel Aviv or about Israel. It's a global thing. It's our reality as the privileged part of society, of the world. being privileged is nothing to be ashamed of. It's a good thing to be able to have a life and to be able to accomplish things. But eventually, there is always a knowledge of what it looks, what it took to get those things in your hands, to have the security that you have, to live in your home, or what it took for your city to be built, your country to be built. And that is something that every person in every country can relate to. All our existence is on somebody's back. Reminding ourselves of that every now and then is important. So Deutsche Welle asks, are people here still being reminded about where they live? Or do people in Tel Aviv just forget about that the West Bank is 25 minutes by car from here? So she says, I have a huge criticism about my generation, but I have a huge criticism about myself. It's extremely easy to forget what's happening, too easy, especially when you live in Tel Aviv. The funny thing is that when you look at the political map, people from Tel Aviv are shallow, pro-Palestinian, pro-two-state solution, but at the same time, you walk the streets here, and it's just as easy to forget. The cafes are bursting with people every single day of the week. I think the most dangerous part of our society is not the one who has hatred towards the other side. The dangerous part is a strong elite who's so forgetful about this situation, who can talk about it from home with paper in hand, so it's not so bad. Maybe the most important of so maybe even post something on Facebook and feel like you did something and then forget about it the rest of the day. That's what it is. But what should people be talking about in the country? What should be the role? 1 second. All right. So question is, what is the role of a musician? She says, I'm not a political artist. I make music for very selfish reasons, for my love of music. It is my way of processing everything that is happening to me and around me. But the byproduct is what I think it can help, she thinks that it can help people if they go deep enough or try to understand what is going on here, maybe read one or two articles about it about what is going on in the Middle East, and people are so responsive today, so quick to talk back. There is a chance to change this through music and listening, maybe even learning. She says, I myself became socially aware because of music. Before that, I was just minding my own business. So yes, I think the music can change the mindset in a human being. She says her military service was a very ridiculous one. I did not contribute anything. I was a singer, a musician in the army. This is a tradition from the 60s and 70s when serious war was going on in Israel, a leftover from an old era. The military band entertaining the soldiers. And this is what I did, she says. It was surreal. In many ways, you take music, which is a very superior thing, a spiritual thing, and you bring about that. You bring that to soldiers in situations where they are just before going out, heading somewhere, which is crazy. They didn't know what would happen to them while they were listening to the music. They didn't even listen. So the other question is, when you were a teenager, teenager when the Second Intifada took place, and do you have the feeling that war was surrounding you all your life? Not really, she says. You know, that's the thing. I'm in the most privileged part of society in Israel, Sometimes there is war or a terror attack, but most of the time it's me. For me, it's quiet, she says. Ask people who live on the border, on the Israeli side, they would describe something different. Ask people in Gaza, in the West Bank, they too would describe something completely different. Yeah, so that's the story there. There is a war going on in Gaza. I can hear alarms there and go to a shelter and just feel, well, I'm evidently falling apart mentally. I guess I'm just exhausted. So whatever the case is, we'll speak to you tomorrow on the 12th of December. And just have a great day. Thanks for being with us. I don't know, I'm literally collapsing here, as if, you know, my eyes want to shut down. Anyway, so that's the story for us today. Well, thank you for being with us as well. We'll speak to you tomorrow. Goodbye.